Then you have something called penetration pricing, which is a very interesting strategy. For example, low pricing is given with aggressive advertising support. So, for example, you have Gillette. Now, Gillette, very often, Gillette, which has a leading market position in large parts of the world when it comes to shaving razors, Gillette has a strategy very often where its razors are actually given away free in a lot of markets. Now, why would they be willing to give away free razors, which would lead to a loss of revenue, even if they are getting a larger number of customers? The fact is that they sell a lot of other premium products where the pricing is steeper. So, if they manage to attract a large number of customers and get a larger market share based on these freebies of the basic razors that they're giving away, then once they have captured this market of loyal customers who trust their brand, who are happy with their brand, then these are the target customers for purchase of their other premium accessories and other premium items, where then they charge a higher price, a premium, which more than make ups for the loss that they may be accumulating because of this free giving away of these razors. So, with a strategy like this, despite these freebies involved, we know how strong their position is globally, and how much of a market leader they are in that segment. Now, likewise, when it comes to Starbucks, they are known to, from time to time, introduce new flavors of coffees, new coffees, new beverages. And very often in the initial phase of their beverage launch, they are going to offer it at a fairly low price, at a fairly attractive price, and which is way lower than the average pricing of Starbucks beverages. And because of this, they will get a lot of people buying this who may actually end up liking the taste. And once the product becomes popular, once the beverage becomes popular, after some time, after they've got a loyal customer base for this new offering, they will withdraw that low pricing and go back to their regular pricing or charge a premium pricing, because now they have an appetite and people would want to continue to consume what they like, even if they have to pay a higher amount. So they have initially got a customer base at an attractive pricing, and once they have locked them in, they then change their pricing and make up for the loss that they may have incurred earlier. So these strategies help, various strategies help in terms of garnering a larger market share, because also people talk about their experiences. So if someone goes and gets a freebie, and then they will tell 10 people about it, and they will be so excited about it, or they try a new flavor, they tell 10 people about it. So these kind of strategies are not simply about gaining that one customer, but they are also about making those customers who are the beneficiaries of the lower pricing or the freebie, making these customers your mouthpieces and your unsuspecting brand ambassadors, who will go and tell 10 people about it, who would also want to come and become participate in your product and become customers to you. Then you have psychological prices. For example, you are charging 1,000 rupees for something. Now suddenly 1,000 rupees becomes four figures. Instead of that, you decide to charge 999. Now, even though it is only 1 rupee less than 1,000 rupees, but still 999 still comes in three figures and not four figures. So it's a very tiny change, but actually it is, when you look at price tags across the board, you will see that not just rupees 999, even when you go to buy internationally, instead of $2, you will see $1.99. So this is a psychological play, but clearly it seems to be working because more and more people adopt it. So people will, get impacted, influenced by these psychological plays. They will get influenced by these, marginally low numbers, which are actually only 1 or 2 rupees or $1 or $2 lower. But they put the price bracket in 3 figures versus 4 figures or 2 figures versus 3 figures. You have the cost plus pricing, where a certain markup is added to the unit cost. So if there is, if a creating a product, manufacturing a product is takes 100 rupees, then the company has decided that I want a 25% profit margin. So for this, I will have to charge 125 rupees. So then it is linked to the pricing is linked to the underlying cost of the product. When it comes to distribution, there is direct selling and then there is indirect selling. So in indirect selling, organizations have to have tie-ups. They have to give up some sort of control. The tie-ups may keep changing. And when it comes to direct selling, there is a lot more centralization and control that the brand has. Different promotions, as we have seen, have to take into account different requirements of the geographies, whether it's cultural, whether it's language, whether it's religious aspects which have to be respected, whether it is pricing aspects, whether it's various aspects. These things have to be taken into account. Now, for language, when we see international brands also, and then we see their messaging in a local language. So this has to be adapted, and one has to respond to this. For example, in certain states, while we use English and Hindi mostly in northern part of the country, but in certain states, the state governments have mandated that, or certain political parties have mandated that the signboards and the even the apps have to be in the local language or the local dialect of that state. Now, this is possible at times, sometimes not possible. Sometimes it has to be implemented. So these aspects have to be taken into account. Now, specific to India, for example, advertising alcohol is banned. So you cannot advertise for Kingfisher beer. So there is proxy advertising which happens. You advertise for a Kingfisher soda water maybe, or when it comes to a Johnnie Walker, you cannot advertise the whiskey, but you can probably advertise Johnnie Walker pens or Johnnie Walker soda water. So there is proxy advertising promotion which comes into play, which in different countries, different geographies, which has to then be the messaging has to be in accordance with that. Understanding different monetary systems, different capital markets. This is a very important aspect of the functionality of international marketing. Gives you a synopsis of the international stock markets worldwide. Keep in mind that the largest stock market is in terms of market capitalization is the New York Stock Exchange. The Bombay Stock Exchange is not the largest stock exchange as far as market capitalization is concerned, but it is the largest stock exchange as far as number of listed companies is concerned. Bombay Stock Exchange, which was set up in 1875. But the largest stock exchange is New York Stock Exchange as far as market capitalization, and the largest electronic stock exchange is the NASDAQ. Working capital management, which is maintaining your cash balances, is very important. For example, if I'm a company which has to pay 100 crores on Wednesday, and I have 100 crores, I'm not going to keep that lying in my current account to be able to make that payment on Wednesday. I will also accordingly plan my receivables in a way so that I can honor this payment on Wednesday. At the same time, if I get my receivables and my money well ahead of time, I'm not going to leave that in my bank account. I might put that in a liquid fund or in deploy it in some other way so that I'm earning some return on it before I have to honor my liability. So working capital management becomes very, very important, especially when it comes to large transactions. These are some of the methods of working capital management which are adopted by businesses. Now again, international cash management has its own modalities, own nuances, and when we had seen the chapter on financing, we had seen forfeiting, factoring, your various other letters of credit, your bankers' advances, etc., which are all helping the maintain this cash flow, liquidity, and the working capital management of the entities involved in cross-border trade. Now, working capital management also has to take in account tax structures, political environments, exchange risk. Now, suddenly when the conflict in Russia happened, when Russia invaded Ukraine, the currency in Russia completely collapsed. Now, that's a risk level that companies would not have been prepared for. That is an outlier kind of event. But obviously, the minute that happened and it became quite evident, then companies and entities would have had to factor in somehow managing to address that and being prepared to still manage your transactions. So foreign exchange risk, tax risk, etc., become important. Now, when we were discussing in one of the chapters, we were discussing the tax case of Vodafone and Hutch. Then we saw how the tax implication of almost 22,500 crores for the capital gains and withholding tax, which was imposed on Vodafone, how that impacted and how long that took. So when it comes to various countries and international businesses, working capital in addition to the other working capital requirements have to take into account a lot of these other risks too. There are different accounting standards, the same as, there are different financial year ending, there are different accounting standards, GAAP, IFRS. So one has to simultaneously maintain when operating in different geographies, one has to simultaneously maintain and report in all the required formats. This gives you some more detail of the corporate finance institution and how the different countries are adopting the different reporting systems and how they have to respond to, how they have to align to the different systems which are different accounting systems which exist, primarily the IFRS and the GAAP. Now, when it comes to tax considerations, by and large, if you see around the 1980s, taxation, the average taxation around the world was much higher than today. Corporate tax rates around the world were anything between 40 to 45% when weighed by GDP. Since then, there has been rationalization of taxation. The average now globally is about 23-25%. When we think about the taxation in India, of course, the highest corporate tax rate in India is still 30%, with the corporate tax rate in India still 30%, and then there is your surcharge and your cess which is levied. So gives you an idea of the kind of taxation, tax regime which exist and how they have evolved over a period of time in the world. There are certain countries which are seen as tax havens where one can save taxes, and people go to these countries for not only saving taxes, but very often because of confidentiality and financial secrecy. So some of the very popular tax havens are Bahamas, British Virgin Islands, Cayman Islands, Island of Jersey, Isle of Man, Mauritius. Now, when we were discussing the chapter on FDI, one of the top three FDI destinations for incoming FDI into India is Mauritius. Now, obviously, it is not coming from Mauritius nationals and only Mauritius entities. It is coming from international investment where these companies globally are investing in India via entities that they have created in Mauritius where they have tax benefits. So there is Panama, there is Monaco, and in fact, from time to time, we have also seen sensational reports and controversies in the paper regarding people who have invested in celebrities and known people who have invested in Panama. There was the whole controversy of the Panama Papers. In the past there was the Saint Kitts political controversy. So there are a lot of times when you will have questions raised about taxes and possible tax escaping mechanisms when investing via one of these countries, but that is a reality of the these tax havens. Even these tax havens are now actually considering levying some sort of taxation, and a lot of countries have agreed that some sort of minimal taxation at least may be considered to be applied here. So let's see how that actually plays out. When it comes to human resource management, there are various aspects. When we were talking about human labor movement across international borders, we were speaking about how India has not been a very, very, other than a few industries like the IT industry, India has not had too much mobility in terms of labor moving across borders, and also the requirements, whether it is in terms of documentation, paperwork, etc., are quite stringent when it comes to Indians working abroad or vice versa. So talking specifically of the IT industry, NASSCOM, which is the National Association of Software Services Companies, it was set up in 1988 and it has about 1,300 members. And NASSCOM has played a vital role in the growth of the Indian industry. It has played a facilitator for the trade between IT and BPO industries. And as we because of that, we have seen a lot of advantages for the human resource management and for the growth of the IT industry, which is obviously happening on the back of this human resource force. Now, just to give you an idea that we have extremely aggressive targets. In India, we have extremely aggressive targets when it comes to our output of the IT industry. Now, our target for 2026, our target is that the IT industry should generate $350 billion in the IT industry contribution. However, that is a little too aggressive, because if we see the last figure of financial year 24, then we are at about 255, approximately 254, 255 billion. So we have a long way to go in just another 2 years. The industry is growing currently at a rate of about 3.84%. It would be very ambitious if we make it to 350 billion. However, it does show you that we are very, very keen to keep growing and to not be impacted by the slowdown that is happening globally, or be impacted by decisions like the WTO, ITA, ITAs, etc. So though, of course, there has been saturation, though there has been decline in growth rates, however, our IT industry, and supported by apex bodies like NASSCOM, still continues to be a vital backbone. And clearly, the investment in the human resources and the contribution of the human resource force, labor force in this industry is going to be absolutely vital. Now, some of the recent trends in the international markets as far as labor forces are concerned in recent years have shown that international assignments are shifting towards emerging markets like Brazil, India, China. So that is a healthy, show of the trends which is happening. Now, even when it comes to manpower, one has to, whether it is inflow of manpower or outflow of manpower, one has to keep in mind cultural factors, economic factors, manpower, cost, industrial relations. Now, whenever we have been talking about all these strikes which have affected the automobile industry across the country in India, then obviously industrial relations issues have come up, which have not been where obviously they have not been handled very well, where challenges have happened, and those should be handled much better. Now, likewise, when we talk about cultural factors or we talk about other factors, for example, there are parts of the Middle East where residents or other citizens of other countries can work, but there are only certain structures based on which they can work. They cannot own businesses, or they need to go into partnership with a local entity or local person. They need a local sponsor. So when it comes to all these factors, then it becomes a little more challenging. One has to understand those. We know labor forces across Indian labor that goes to other parts. Certain other parts can face challenging when it comes to, a lot of them have to submit their passports and are completely dependent on their employer to release their passport should they even want to come back, leave and come back. So a lot of these factors and environments in those countries, from a participation point of view, from a rights point of view, from a cost point of view, have to be kept in mind. There was a very rather unfortunate incident which happened recently in one of the Middle Eastern countries, where one of the housing complexes that was housing laborers, including several laborers from India, caught fire, massive fire, and unfortunately there were a lot of casualties. Now that highlights the state of the labor force in those countries and how challenging it is for them in those countries. So different countries, different geographies have different environments. Before any laborer, any country decides to operate there or send its labor force there, they have to keep in mind the environment in those countries and how well that would work. Now, likewise, in recent years, there was also within this year, there was that issue of another episode in the Middle East where certain 7 or 8 former naval officers who were now working for a private firm were arrested in a certain country on allegations of espionage, and it was a very, very scary scenario. Fortunately, our Indian government intervened and managed to bring them back to India, but you can imagine what a challenging environment that would have been, and the intricacies and the nuances which would have led to a situation like that, and how much understanding and how much sensitivity would have been required on part of the Indian government to be able to diffuse that situation and bring our citizens back from that horrendous situation. Different countries, different cultural factors, especially I have given examples of Japan, where they believe in not only small cultural gestures like meishi, like, different colors, different numbers, but also in terms of the commitment towards employment. They typically do not appreciate this people jumping jobs and, how people, young people especially, tend to move companies every 2 to 3 years, jump jobs every 2 to 3 years. They prefer long-term lifetime employment experience, and so policies are designed accordingly. They do not culturally appreciate this, jumping from one company to the next for position or money or various things, which also again brings me back to the example of General Motors. One of the reasons why their brand and their image in the country suffered was because within a span of 35 years, they changed within a span of rather 21 years, they changed almost 9 CEOs. So that's not even more than 3 years. How long in a new country, in a different country, can you really establish your reputation when you have so much change at the top management? Versus that, when we look at Maruti, Suzuki, when we look at them in their 35 years of operations in the country, or when we look at Maruti in the 35 years of operations in the country, they have had, or they are still on their fifth CEO. So the tenure there has been on an average almost 7 to 8 years per CEO. So that clearly shows you that longevity has its, while longevity, you know, some people may feel, you know, stagnated, longevity of employment has its benefit from a reputation point of view, from a reliability trust point of view, and accordingly, markets and customers respond positively to that. And so what works in any market, HR policies would have to be designed around that. Various economic factors come into play. In free-based economies, the HR costs, the HR policies can be very different. When it comes to socialist economies, then these decisions don't become too relevant, because the basic requirement is not just you know, growth. It is just about making sure that unemployment doesn't happen, making sure that basic needs of food, clothing, housing, you know, are taken care of, and we are not really dealing with productivity and efficiency, etc. We are just about dealing with sustaining basic needs of the employees. So it is not a matter of quality, efficiency, productivity. It is simply a matter of keeping as many employed as possible. Manpower costs are a very, very sensitive issue. Lot of the unrest which happens, especially in large manufacturing facilities, is based on the knowledge that manpower remunerations in other parts of the world are far superior to manpower remunerations for employees in corresponding manufacturing units in India or other parts of developing low income countries. So definitely this knowledge does travel, and because of this there is a lot of unrest. Hence even our local labor, and rightly so, looks for performance related pay, looks for variable pay. Also in India there is a preference for a higher fixed pay. Now in a lot of the international markets, the proportion of fixed pay is lower and a lot of the pay is actually on variable basis. However, in India, we like stability, we like surety. So a larger part of the demand and requirement is for a higher component of fixed pay. Now that may or may not be in sync or in alignment with the policy of the international entity. Various other factors have to be kept in mind, like your human resource, industrial relations, your recruitment and training of staff. You have to have an alignment between your head offices, whatever part of the world they may be in, and your local locations. And there has to be, the suitable employees and executives across these different locations have to be, recruited. Now, very often when you have expat staffing, expatriate staffing at senior levels in India, so a lot of the multinational entities will very often have expats. Now, very often that while the expat is here, it leads to tensions, because local employees tend to observe that the expats are at a very, very high remuneration package, way higher than their Indian counterparts. And these expat staffing, a lot of them actually come on India by something as a category which is called punishment posting or hardship posting, which actually means, hardship posting means that you will get extra bonuses for working here because the conditions here are so tough. And actually, they are living the high life while being here. Whereas at their level in their own country, they may not have the kind of remuneration package, or they may not have a chauffeur driven car, or they may not have a penthouse in South Bombay being provided by the company and various other perks and leave and all of those things. Whereas just by being positioned in India, they are being entitled to a lot of these benefits, and life is actually not that hard. It's actually very luxurious. So that, difference is very, that gap is very glaring for expat staffing versus local staffing. And very often it leads to hostility and tensions where people feel that it's very unfair for that kind of staffing. And the expats are not justifying the remuneration packages they are receiving. And possibly there are a lot of able, productive local employees who could actually benefit a lot more with a better remuneration package and also deliver a much higher productivity, while at the same time being a lot more familiar with the local requirements and cultures. This gives you a synopsis of what a successful international executive, the qualities and characteristics they should embody, which would make them a success, which would also help in the entire image of the image building and the eventual success of the international company or the multinational. Thank you.